Thanks very much, too, to the panel, to Shara, Shane, and, of course, also to Michael again. So Michael's given us a real tour de force of central banking thinking, and he really started his beginning of his discussion way back at the Fed in 1994, before they actually even announced what the Fed funds rate was. Australia was about the same in that sort of thing, and I actually remember that. It goes back to my central banking days, where we used to have this wonderful term whereby the central bank would snuggle the market, where they would make a decision to change, but they wouldn't announce it, and they would do a little bit of a yield move up on one day and then take a little bit back and the next thing from there. Of course, that's long gone. We don't do central banking like that anymore. It's all about clear frameworks and transparency and good communications and that sort of thing, which we're going to talk about today. But I do sort of feel like we've got to find some reason to bring back the word snuggle the market. I think that's just kind of a really great term. Anyway, that's really what the essence of Michael's talk was about. What is that framework and how do we go about trying to use it usefully, knowing that this is a really difficult challenge because, after all, the world's messy. We see the world as messy all the time in the sense of supply shocks or behaviour that does one thing or another thing. You can never really know what's predictable. And so the issue that I want to start in the first block of questions is this one around how within that world do we actually set up good communications and good central banking behaviour. Then I'm going to move on to some of the contemporary economic challenges that we have in Australia and other countries around the world and get the panel's views on some of those. And then I'll move over to Q&A at the end of the session. So that's kind of where we're going on all of this. But before we start on any of that, I just want to take a huge step backwards and maybe to, well, maybe I'll turn to you, Shane, first of all, and say, look, why do we care about what the inflation rate is? I mean, you know, well, who cares if it's 2% or 5% or 8% or whatever? Obviously, it went pretty, was 2, went up to 8. Now it's back around 3.5 or so. And perhaps you could tell us a little bit about, you know, why do we care to get it back into a range that we set? You know, it's 3.5. Is that good enough? Is that close enough? Give us a bit of a thoughts about why, from your experience in working in financial markets, we should care about this sort of question.
It's a good question, David, and maybe you picked on me because I was around in that time. Not recently, but of course recently, but back in the 1970s. So I might be the oldest here, but I do remember when inflation was, I think the high point was 17.5% in 1974. One day I came back, I was about 14 years old, from the shopping centre, and I just put some money in, I think in United Permanent Building Society, and it might have been St George, one of those two, and with the whiz-bang interest rate of 10%. And so I tell my father that I'm getting a 10% interest rate. And he said, well, that's great, son. Or Shane, he never used the word son, Shane. And the problem is the rate of inflation is 17%, so you're actually going backwards. And it was through that period in the 1970s that initially people didn't worry about it too much. Inflation actually got out of control, or started to get out of control, in the US in the late 1960s. It was already on the way up. So the 50s and 60s were generally quite low. By the late 60s, it started to rise. Lots of people blame easy, cheap financing of the Vietnam War, the Great Society, which is a social welfare program under the Democrats in the US, Johnson. So by the time we get to the 1970s oil shocks, it was already, confidence in central banks and low inflation was already substantially weakened. And the problem with the 70s, I think, highlighted several things. One is there is a cost to high inflation. It's a shoe leather cost. You spend, economists used to call it that when I went to university at Macquarie in the late 70s, early 80s, that you spend a lot of time trying to protect yourself against it. And, of course, the shoe leather cost comes in that you've got to go to the bank every so often and get your money out and make sure you spend it, because your salary when deposited in the bank becomes less. So there's extra effort involved in trying to deal with it and make sure you don't lose your money. Secondly, it results in uncertainty. So businesses don't know what's going to happen. So uncertainty levels went up in the 1970s. It all has an impact on financial markets. So if you look at the performance of equities and bonds in the 1970s, as an investor, it was one of the worst times to be an investor. And as Central Bank Governor Bullock regularly points out, Michelle Bullock regularly points out, the cost to it is it's easier for rich people to avoid inflation and protect themselves against it and get hedges against it in their investments. It's a lot harder for less well-off people, so it has a distributional impact as well. And, of course, finally, it results in much higher interest rates, as we saw in the 1970s. There was a lagged response in the 1970s. There was always a tendency to think inflation's going to come back down, don't worry about it. And, of course, it never did. There was also regulation of interest rates and bond yields. It was only in the 1980s when the true costs came to the fore with very high interest rates. And by the end of the 80s, when we went to 1990, and I recall well the first announcement by the central bank in January of 1990, I think the only time they've had a meeting in January, was to cut interest rates. And from that point onwards, we've been told what the cash rate is in Australia. But that was down from 18%. And by that point in time, mortgage rates had hit 17%. So it results in much higher interest rates. So if you've got a mortgage and you think, well, what's wrong with a bit of inflation? Surely we should have lower interest rates. Well, the longer term outcome will be you get higher inflation, investors will demand more money and more higher return, higher interest to invest in the country, to put the money in the bank, and you'll end up paying much higher interest rates. The final cost, of course, was that to get it back down again, once it's out of control, genie's out of the bottle, requires very high unemployment. And by the early 1990s in Australia, we lagged a little bit in getting it under control. We had unemployment pushing towards 11%. And that was a cost of it as well. So there's lots of costs. I think it's critically important to get it right. I think central banks have been right to go hard, even though at points in time I've been too optimistic as to how far they actually need to go. They've needed to go further than I would have thought. But I think ultimately they've done the right thing, and we will look back and say that was good. Only problem is that you've got a good saying there that people don't know the dog that doesn't bark. They don't hear the dog that doesn't bark. People tend to blame the central bank for all their woes, but things would have been far, far worse if they had enacted to bring inflation back down again.
Wow, that was a long answer. but all right, we'll move on. So, Michael, credibility. We're just sticking to the basics here. Why do we care about central banks having credibility? What's the advantage of that? And then I want to move on perhaps to Sarah about the challenge of actually creating it. Just tell us in a couple of words, why do we care about this sort of stuff you're talking about? And is it just an inside the beltway kind of stuff that we're doing about? Or what's the importance of credibility for central banks?
It goes in the direction of what Shane was just saying. I mean, if you are an investor and you believe the central bank will hit their target, 2% over the next 10 years, then you will use that in your calculation of how much you're going to charge when you make your mortgage decisions. If you think, you know, the way they're talking or the person they've appointed or the fact that the government has said, you know, we don't like central bank independence anymore, we're going to take control again, any of those things would make people go, I'm not sure they're actually going to hit 2%. You may not know. It might be right back to the uncertainty world, but you worry. You worry that, yeah, maybe they'll hit it at 2. There's a good chance they won't. There's a good chance they'll be stuck at 4 or 5. And because there's this cost, you know, this is a transfer between those who borrow money, gain, and those who have lent it, lose, because we lend typically in nominal contracts. That's a cost. If you're faced with that potential cost, you lock it into your rates. So this is where I talk about the grip on the steering wheel. You can have a world where the central bank is telling you that they'll keep interest rates at some level and that's enough to achieve the target. But if people don't believe them and markets don't believe them, those interest rates go up anyway, right? So, you know, the worst thing you can have is a central bank who says, oh, to be popular, we're not going to raise rates. Because the people are going to face the higher rates anyway, and you've just lost all your credibility. So now you the world is faced with a world with no one credibly controlling inflation. So that's why we have independent central banks. That's why periods like the US with Trump and the country I live in now, where we, you know, the UK decided to become an emerging market for a few weeks. I'm sure countries around the world enjoyed looking at, you know, the old colonial power behaving like a banana republic for 6 weeks. But that's where losing that credibility turned up. Like, you know, and we can argue about the political costs. People's mortgages went up by 200 basis points for sustained periods of time because of that madness. So policy credibility is just really fundamental. We probably got a little comfortable because most countries have it, independent central banks, and things were working pretty well. Fiscal was doing all right. It can disappear pretty quickly. So it remains, it should be high on the sort of radar of what we need to guard.
So basically what you're saying there is that we want to have inflation expectations really well anchored, to use the jargon, because then we get a lower risk premium. And that means we don't end up with the consequent cost of that and, of course, the political challenges that come from that, of which the UK showed us a wonderful example of what happens when you let that go.
You're welcome.
So, yeah, thanks very much for that. So, Sarah, you know, you're the banks, obviously, the RBA is obviously in charge of creating this credibility. The bank's now very transparent. It puts out its models. It talks a lot in communications and all this stuff. But as I just said at the beginning, the world's messy. There's all sorts of changes, and they happen a lot more in the short run than they do kind of in the long run. You know, we can all predict how wealthy we're going to be in 20 years' time, but we can't predict what's going to happen in the next 2 years. How do you go around creating credibility in a world where you know you're not likely to be right in your narrative that you come out right now? And in fact, the bank's so transparent, it puts out its errors of its forecasting in what's called the fan charts. And they're really wide for 2 years or so. How does one go about trying to sort of bring in this anchored expectations when you know there's just so much you can't really control within that narrative?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think we use a number of different sort of techniques, I suppose, or tools at our disposal, some that are our complete disposal, some that are imposed on us from outside, and I think that they're very valid and proper and right. I suppose to start at a very high level, we have our mandate. It's given to us by government, by the parliament. It's therefore a reflection of what the people want us to do. And it's pretty clear on what they want us to do. They want us to achieve in this country inflation between 2 and 3%. And we're now actually a further sort of refinement of the mandate in the latest statement, the conduct of monetary policies. We say specifically when we're going to be back at 2.5%, we think. And also, of course, maintaining employment as close as we can to full employment. So we have that balance in our mandate. So there's a very clear go and do this job, please, statement from the government that we're given. And then we're held to account on it. We, you know, inflation is measured. You can look at our performance in terms of achieving that mandate. And to your point, we back that up ourselves by being open and honest and transparent. And in fact, it's part of the new culture that we're trying to build at the bank, is we're calling open and dynamic. And so it's built into the very fabric of the place that we try and hold ourselves to account as much as possible. And we want the public to hold us to account as well. So I, as part of my role with the governor and with others, we have to go and report to Parliament on a regular basis what we're doing, why we're doing it. The media hold us to account on a very regular basis, and that's very good and proper and right. My colleague actually, Andrew Houser, the Deputy Governor, gave some remarks earlier this week. They're on our website. I recommend you read them because they're exactly on this topic of central bank communication and why openness and transparency is so important. And he's got his own very unique style and sense of history. So I really would recommend you have a read if you haven't already. But we do try and hold ourselves to account, as I said. And we're all the time looking at how we can be more open and transparent and honest in our thinking. To your point, the world is innately uncertain. I'm not sure we'll ever hear someone say a precedent of uncertainty, but I take the point. It's very well made. The world is always uncertain. Our forecasts do come with very wide error bands as you move further forward through time. Or put another way, it gets harder and harder to know exactly what's going to happen as we go down the track. And so 2 years is bigger uncertainty than 1 year, is a bigger uncertainty than 6 months, and so on. The way we think about that internally and the way we challenge ourselves all the time internally is to think, well, how could we be wrong? How could this play out in a different way to the way we currently expect? And what might that look like? That's a conversation that's always happened internally. We're now trying to have that conversation much more externally. If you've had a look at, I don't expect anyone to, it's not exactly a ripper read, but our latest statement of monetary policy, for the people who do love this stuff, we now have in there scenarios that we've run where we do consider these what ifs. What might the world look like if we're wrong on a certain key judgment or key assumption? So that's one way we're trying to tackle it. And, of course, in our communications as well, We try very hard to be clear on what the conditionality is around what's going on in the outlook and what that might mean. And we're always very happy to be challenged on that. So it's tough, and I don't want to suggest that we don't know anything at all about what's going on. We do. We monitor and track the economy all the time, and we do have, you know, certainly in the very near term, a reasonable idea of how things are going to play out. But a big part of it is being honest about what may be different, and then what that might look like for the economy.
Yeah. I think that's a very deft way of answering the question, but it's a real delicate balance, isn't it? In fact, it's a delicate dance, I reckon, because how do you acknowledge the uncertainties of the future in a transparent manner and not end up shooting yourself in the foot in your ability to actually say that you still have some influence over the outcome of where it's going and hence this is what we're trying to do? How does one strike that right balance?
Yeah, it is challenging. I think to the discussion Mike was having earlier on, what we're really hoping to communicate is a sense of what the reaction function of the board is. So the world might not play out the way we think it will in our baseline forecast, but if things start to happen, how might we react in terms of pulling different policy levers? So, for example, when COVID hit, it was clear this was a very big negative shock, highly uncertain as to how that was going to play out. Clearly, though, in the very near term, if I think back to March 2020, we were going to see a severe downturn in economic activity. We were talking about having to shut down whole parts of the economy, which obviously then did happen. In that world, I don't think, I hope it wasn't too surprising to anyone to see that the response from us was to loosen policy quite substantially. So we took the cash rate right down. We put in place things like the term funding facility, yield curve control on targets and things like that, a whole range of policies. Sure, the specifics may not have been entirely obvious ex ante, so Shane, and even me at the time, we perhaps didn't know exactly what the board were going to decide in terms of their policy response. But I think we were both pretty clear, and others in the profession, they were going to do something, and it was probably going to be quite substantial. It was going to support the economy, and that obviously then came true. So we can't be exactly precise, of course, because you don't know exactly what situation you're going to be facing, and I hope very much, touch wood, that I'm not leaning into another pandemic anytime soon. But I think I can touch wood and say with some certainty, something will come along. I don't know what the something will be. We don't. But something will come along. And so what we're trying to do all the time is, yes, obviously set policy for today. And right now we are still battling inflation. And that is, as the board has said many times, the critical challenge of right now. In the future, there will be something else that we'll be facing into. And so a lot of our communication and what we're really trying to do is give people a real clear understanding of how we're likely to respond in the future so they can make their decisions based on that. And then let's see what tomorrow brings. But as I say, hopefully not another pandemic.
You never know. Shane, we speak as if we, you know, when we say as if communications and it's a unified audience, but of course it's not a unified audience. There's communications where to the financial markets, much of Michael's talk was about that. But the real people that we're trying to influence is the general public. And their understanding of the nuances of all this stuff is obviously very different for us. Moreover, the general public wants a lot more certainty about exactly what we're going to do in this future. Well, they'd like to know what the future is, including when the next pandemic is coming, but also a lot more certainty about what's actually happening. And they have a very different way of communicating. You know, they communicate in 140 characters. How does one manage, you know, a communication process where it's not just to folks like yourself at AMP in the financial markets, but actually to be effective in this broader sense? Of actually the businesses and the households that are trying to make their financial decisions and which you really want to anchor their expectations in that zone, but it's a different way in which the financial markets would listen and nuance.
That's true. I think back to that snugging or snuggles period, the role of the economists back then was to try and work out what exactly the Reserve Bank was doing. Now it's a lot simpler, and the Reserve Bank tells you, and then you try and work out a bit of nuance around that. Do you have a slightly different view to the Reserve Bank in terms of the outlook for the economy or inflation or so on? But I think it really comes down to the central bank telling everyone what their inflation objective is and what the objective for employment is. Obviously, that to some degree is given to them by the government. It's agreed with the government on a regular basis, and they sign and exchange documents. So as Sarah said, you know, the Parliament has agreed to this, and that's what's given to the Reserve Bank. You could ask, why do we choose 2 to 3%? I think that's probably a lot of debate around that, but it's not 5, 6, 10% or something like that. It's just a lowish number. If you go too low, you have other problems. So we'll leave that as it is. But I think it's a matter of saying, this is our objective, and then behaving in ways and communicating in ways that indicate to people that you are heading in that direction. So if you go back to 2022, partly as Michael's charts indicated, there was a lot of uncertainty. Initially, central banks were saying it's transitory, it's not going to be an issue in Australia, don't worry about it. I think once central banks worked out what was happening, the tune quickly changed, and it became quite clear that they're adamant, dedicated to getting inflation back to the 2% in the US, 2 to 3% in Australia. And so therefore, I think they've done the right thing. There will be times when a central bank doesn't quite know what's happening and their communications can be a little bit off as they're trying to scramble to work out. But as long as they're constantly communicating the 2 to 3%, so everyone knows that, and backing that up with actions, then I think people will come to believe it. And that's important because if people believe it, then companies, when they set wage budgets for the next year, will work on 3 or 4 or something like that. Workers will say, OK, I'm happy with 4% wage rise, inflation's that, I won't demand more. They'll be suspicious of companies that put up their prices by 10% and so on. So that's why it's so important that this objective be well known, which it is, and the central bank clearly back it up with action, which I think they're doing.
Yeah. Absolutely. So coming on then to sort of updating into the COVID crisis, and this is a question really that maybe, Michael, you want to expand a bit more on and from your material. You know, obviously, the COVID years were a supply shock, a demand shock, a potential financial stability shock, all rolled into one. And, you know, the government recognised, well, the policymakers recognised that, hey, this was a big deal and we're going to fire every bazooka we can at this thing because we're really worried about the worst of the risk outcomes. And they did it. And from every direction, central banks, budgets, whatever. And then in the end, we didn't get the 10% unemployment. We got the $10 lettuce instead. And now everyone's running around complaining about the $10 lettuce and how terrible it is and the experts got it wrong and look what's happened and whatever, totally forgetting that the alternative, if you hadn't done, in the end, more than enough to guard against the worst risk, is that you would have got this mass unemployment. I mean, in all the students I teach, I keep asking them, hey, what would you rather? High prices or none of you getting a job for the next 5 years as soon as you graduate? And I haven't met anyone who's complained about the high prices in that consideration. How do we recognise that, look, the general population is always backward-looking and thinking, well, you know, what happened in the end and I'm then looking for someone to blame if I don't like the outcome and not seeing, as in fact Shane said before, the dog that didn't bark, which was in this case guarding against the worst of the alternatives that were on the table and very much in the forecasts, including the public forecasts of places like the Reserve Bank.
Yeah, I mean, apart from sending everyone to Macquarie to do an economics degree so they learn how to do counterfactual analysis, now this actually resonates even more. So as was pointed out at the start, I until August, I was chair of Ireland's Fiscal Advisory Council, and now I've stepped back to deputy chair. But I've been on the council for nearly 6 years now, and this is an independent council that has, you know, advised the Irish government. Advise isn't even the right term. We assess, and we basically tell them when they're doing good things and what's not great and what they could do better. But quite a lot of that is pointing out risks. And, you know, we are the boy who cried wolf. You know, we point out that Ireland right now gets a lot of corporate tax revenue from multinationals, and that could disappear. But it hasn't disappeared yet. And so every year people go, you said it could disappear. Yeah, we didn't say when. But like Sarah was saying, you know, some of these things are a when, not an if. But the best approach to it is to talk about it, be open about it, be clear about it, talk about the options. But every year the politicians look back at us and go, wrong again. So counterfactual analysis is always hard. For central banks, and I just to pick up on your last question about the general public, talking to the general public has only been a concern for central banks in the last 12 years, right? Before that, central bankers held the wonderful position in public opinion as being equivalent to doctors. They don't know, nobody knows exactly what they do, but they trust them implicitly. That's true in surveys. If people
like those days,
exactly, people would compare economists in central banks and places like that to like I don't know exactly what they do day to day, but yeah, I do trust they'll do it well. QE and these things, which look like a big handout to the financial sector, really hurt that opinion. And opinion in most trust in most central banks around the world has dropped. And as a result, the charm offensive has started. And we're still learning. I do a lot of research on how you reach normal people. Again, not to say everyone in this room is not normal, but economists are not normal. We have to figure it out. And there are three big challenges that have come out from this. And one of them is the one I was referring to. So Andy Haldane and I, in a paper, talked about the three E's of communicating with the general public. And they are explanation, engagement, and education. So when I was talking about teaching people counterfactual analysis, there's an education point there. But engagement is, you know, if you give the average person the choice to watch cat videos on YouTube or read the monetary policy statement, I'm sorry. As much as I've written it down, I want to go read your scenarios because they're a hot topic in my world. In most worlds, they are not. And even when people, so I do experiments where I force people, pay people to read central bank statements. And there is a real problem of people just not understanding the type of jargon we use. Not even like long sentences, and central bankers have a way of writing that I was trained in. When I started my career at the Bank of England, we learned how to write what was called bank style, which involved incredible precisions, many subclauses, really, you know, really turgid stuff, like real boring, turgid drafting. And I think central banks are having to re-examine this trade-off between precision of language and accessibility and access to it. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. You can have your financial market statement, and then you can have your statement that's aimed at the more general public. But there are risks with that. And so there's a balance and a new world out there that central bank comms departments have to do.
Are you saying central banks and the Reserve Bank should be on TikTok doing little videos explaining things?
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, most central banks are now on Twitter, or what now is X. But even if you look at them, so I did this in a paper a few years ago. In fact, and I even updated it just last week. The Bank of England has 1.2 million followers on X, which is in a country of 65 million, and a bunch of the followers are not even in the UK. Taylor Swift has 95 million. So we still have some way to go. But there are papers. Michael Ehrman and one of my PhD students, Alina Wabich, have a paper in an academic journal which shows that central banks do get through to non-experts via Twitter. And TikTok is another way, and Instagram. But central banks are always about three social media behind. You know, so they're on X now because they only just got off Facebook. And, TikTok's probably 5 years away.
You heard it here first. It's social media is coming. Just one question on
that. What do you say to the argument that if we were in a world where they didn't, they just snuggled and they hardly told us anything, that people respected them because they were just in an elite institution? Now they talk a lot. I don't believe this, but you could make an argument. Now they talk a lot. They're very open in their communications. That might actually reduce central bank credibility.
We are in a world where if the central bank is not actively out there putting a correct narrative out there, someone else will fill the void with some nonsense. Those voices are still out there, but you have to try and counter them. You won't counter all misinformation. This is not just a central bank problem. This is a more widespread issue. But I think it would be neglectful for an independent central bank with the need for accountability and transparency to not be out there putting a narrative in the public domain. And we've seen in the US, you know, you could argue the Fed has generally been a very independent central bank and has always had that position. Well, under Trump, that came under real threat because he would come out with statements like, oh, that Powell guy, he's not a good guy. I thought he was a low interest rate guy. He's done bad stuff. When will he wake up? And this generates a swell of people going, as was alluded to earlier, the central bank is to blame for all of this. So the best world we can live in is one where people do understand the logic of central banking and these trade-offs that get made, and the fact that, yeah, we may have to have some higher interest rates now, but it's better than having permanently higher interest rates and then permanently higher inflation. That's the challenge, but they have to be active. If they're not, right, they're dead.
Well, that's a good segue into the next part of where I want to talk about in the future sort of setting and go back to Sarah again and say, look, inflation's back to 3.5% now. How much of the current inflation is just actually changes in relative prices? And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a huge push up in house prices, which is a sort of a permanent change because we just decide to underbuild in this country. And there's a huge push up in insurance because we've got a climate change crisis going on. There's a big increase in going on in margins because we have a competitiveness problem. All of these are changes in relative prices, which then get fed into the index and make it much harder, of course, to achieve a 2.5% on average like it was in the last 30 years. What's the thinking about these sort of factors and how they should come into the perspective about perhaps the timeline or whatever else in the thinking the other?
So it's a really good question. I suppose I'd say maybe my general answer to your question is it's always the case at any given point in time that some parts of the inflation basket will be rising at faster than 2.5%, and other parts of the basket will be rising at less, lower than 2.5%. And we're targeted specifically on headline inflation, and we're looking to achieve 2.5% as, you know, over time. So those kind of relative price shifts that you're talking about, they're always to some extent happening. Why they're happening is a good question. Is it structural changes that we're observing? You mentioned some of those there, particularly around the climate transition. I think that's clearly an important structural shift that's going to run through the economy for quite some time, run through the world economy for quite some time, assuming the policy settings stay as they are in a broad sense. But other reasons, can be other reasons why some parts of the basket run above 2.5% for a shorter period of time, and you might call that much more cyclical or temporary. And so, actually, to use your lettuce example from earlier, part of the problem there, of course, was that there was a storm that wiped out the lettuce crop. The best example of this in Australia, which I love going back to, is way back in 2011 when there was a tropical storm called Yasi that wiped out the banana crop up in northern Queensland. Banana prices went up by 400% year on year for a while, and then they came back down over the following year because the bananas came back. Obviously, the farmers replanted and what have you. So to answer your question, there can be lots of different reasons why different parts of the basket are moving at a different pace. Some of them we might think that we would look through. Banana prices going up because of tropical storms, we can't do much about that with interest rates. Frankly, not many people can do much about that on a very short-term basis. Other reasons, though, we do have to worry about, of course. And at the moment, what we see happening, notwithstanding, there are still shocks like that that are running through on specific products, specific prices. Generally speaking, we can still see in the data some persistence in inflation. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why, although we're targeted on headline inflation, that's right, that's what people experience overall. We do use underlying inflation or trim mean inflation as a way of trying to strip out some of these extreme volatile movements. And so when we look at underlying inflation, which strips out on either end of the tail, we can still see that that's running comfortably above our target, so above 2 to 3%, certainly comfortably above 2.5%. And that's what's concerning us. That's why we're really focused on this. The board are still focused absolutely on bringing inflation back down because we haven't seen that moderation yet. It's really, if you look over the last year or so, the quarterly profile does go up and down. That happens. But there's been really quite a modest amount of disinflation. The board are very conscious of that. That's been communicated in quite a few different forums, and we can still see that. And so I suppose the answer to your question is, notwithstanding that there'll be some things going faster and slower, even looking through all of that, we can still see that there's general price pressure in the system, and that's what we're concerned about. I think the final answer, though, to your question, perhaps to give a slightly different perspective on it, we are very conscious, and we do know that structural shifts and changes happen through the economy all the time for lots of reasons. It's an important part of what we do to understand those, to understand how they're going to manifest themselves in inflation and in, you know, the economy more broadly, and then for me and my team to advise the board on what we think that means in terms of policy. So we do that as well. So we are thinking, for example, about the climate transition. But unfortunately, for right now, that doesn't explain what's happening, and that's why we are still so focused on getting inflation back to target.
The other thing that, of course, is entering into the inflation question and the outlook right now is fiscal policy. And so, Shane, tell us a bit about your thoughts about, you know, is the government actually just adding to the problems here through its spending patterns, the disability spend, the military spend, the cost of living relief spend, which is just more spend, and... You know, should there be a better effort to sort of coordinate, and how would that look, or so forth? You must have thought about this question over many years, because it turns up perennially in the economist world. What's your thoughts on fiscal policy in Australia?
It certainly does. That I'll start with the last question, because that is a good one. In an ideal world, and Governor Lowe, former governor at the Central Bank, used to say this quite regularly, that there would be a better way, that is, where fiscal policy and monetary policy work in unison. They certainly worked in unison through the pandemic and helped give us that stronger recovery. But oftentimes they're working in opposite directions. You could argue the Reserve Bank was running relatively easy monetary policy prior to the pandemic. The government was running through austerity, so going in opposite directions. And you could argue, depending on which indicator you look at, that maybe there's a degree of the same thing happening now. The Reserve Bank is trying to cool things down, whereas government spending has been perpetually surprising on the upside. You go back a few years ago, I think the projections were for 1.5% growth in public spending. Now they're about 4%. Initially, I wasn't opposed to the cost of living increases, but then after a while, you start to worry that they are contributing to spending in the economy and making the Reserve Bank's job harder. So I think it would have been... In an ideal world, it would have been more useful if fiscal policy was tightened at the same time as monetary policy. It would make the Reserve Bank's job easier. But, of course, it's always difficult to get politicians to do that. That's why I think it's right that the responsibility for controlling inflation stays at the Reserve Bank. You can't rely on governments to tighten when they need to. They'll ease when they need to because they get votes for that, but they won't tighten when they need to. So I think that's been a major issue, and ideally, yes, there would be better coordination, but it's very hard to get politicians to move in the right direction when they need to. But the answer to the first question is yes. I think government spending, particularly in infrastructure, we need lots of infrastructure spending, but you go and ask people who build units what their problem is. Well, one of their big problems is that they're competing with infrastructure projects, similar workforce, similar building material costs and so on, and that's making it a lot harder for them to get their units out of the ground, exacerbating the home building crisis. So if governments had slowed down infrastructure investment at this point in time, it could have taken a lot of the pressure off.
So, Michael, that brings me actually into the next part of, you know, one obvious way around the inflation problems and the challenges that Shane just outlined is to have a much better supply response, which is, you know, in economist language, the productivity response. Productivity, amount of output we get for each hour worked, hasn't changed in Australia since 2016. So we've had 8 years of no growth in output per hour, which ultimately is the defining ingredient for our standard of living, unless the Chinese want to keep giving us more and more for our red and black rocks, which looks in doubt at the moment. So, Michael, the question here is, you know, there's no shortage in Australia of ideas about how to promote productivity. There's no shortage of talk about productivity, but there's a big shortage of any action on the ground by any governments at any level. And I'm talking productivity widely here about sort of, you know, competitiveness, housing, all those sorts of stuff, even maybe AI-like sort of things. What are there lessons of other countries or perhaps your experience in Ireland or so forth about how to actually just get on and start doing something in this space that actually seems to align between the voters' reluctance for change and the consequent politicians' reluctance to even do anything outside of just blither.
So I spread my thinking across two countries, and the one where I live would be delighted if productivity had just stayed the same, because the UK productivity has slowed over that same period, whereas Ireland has actually been very successful. What is the trick? Well, I think the big trick in Ireland has been essentially outsourcing it to multinationals, which has been a big driver of positive change, both in domestic firms, but also with the international firms coming in. But they're doing their darndest for the same reasons, it sounds like, in Australia, to make us less competitive going forward. We have the same construction problem. We have the same infrastructure problem. We have the same constraints now that we need to build more houses and do more infrastructure, but we don't have enough builders to do the private stuff or the fiscal stuff. And on the fiscal side, a lot of the attention is always on the big projects. But a lot of, I think, you could tidy up the little things. You know, can we have better childcare policies in place, better support for female labour participation? Can we have better work from home policies? COVID actually helped on those things to some degree. I don't know how they've changed here, but you know, work from home is now a norm in many industries that it wasn't before. So, but again, the desire to have a big response on any of the what are the big ticket things like AI? Well, again, I'm old enough to remember the internet revolution. And the internet revolution, the famous line about the internet revolution in about the late 90s was, the internet revolution has turned up everywhere except in the productivity statistics. Now, I think that's a measurement problem. And I think if we were to think, can we... I flew over here. I took the direct flight from London to Perth. And I was a little surprised that Qantas does not have Wi-Fi at all on that flight. It was a little disappointing because on most flights now internationally, you can get at least some Wi-Fi. It might be intermittent, but you can get the odd WhatsApp about out and get some emails. And they didn't. And I thought, God, I was disconnected from the web for 17 hours. And I just thought, well, you know, 20 years ago, when I started undergraduate, I was in the first undergraduate class at Trinity College Dublin that all got email addresses as standard. But you had to queue at a computer room to log on to use it. And now it's like, well, if this thing in my pocket doesn't have constant access, my life doesn't. So I imagine our productivity today is massively reliant on the internet, even if we can't trace it formally in the statistics. I imagine the same will happen with AI. So I hope governments get on with having policies to support it, You also have to be careful with AI, right? There's a whole bunch of risks. So I think AI is one where we need to manage it carefully. But if governments want to do something now, I think there's a lot of little things they can do. And they don't even have to cost a lot of money. And they don't even have to add a lot of demand. So ideally, we pursue those. And again, I think there's huge opportunities as well for a big one. And we should be doing these on the green transition. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that governments need to be doing. And some of it is fiscal spending, but other is just regulatory and, you know, putting in place an environment where we can get more car chargers for EVs, where we can, you know, encourage their use. But I don't know, they don't win votes as much as, you know, building a new factory in your local area if you're an MP. And there's an election coming up, so that's the world.
Yeah, I think you're right. On the Qantas thing, that's because, you know, they turn off the Wi-Fi because you're supposed to watch the same R-rated movie over the whole plane for 17 hours, apparently. Those of you who know the media of late. So, look, let me wrap up with one last question before I turn to Q&A. And it actually comes back and hopefully ties some of this stuff together, particularly on the comms side and this latter stuff about how we get better reforms. And it's an issue about really whether or not by better communications, I'm not quite sure by whom, whether we can get more focus on evidence-based policy into the dialogue and into the discussions, which is a messy world as well. Everyone's going to have their different view on what's evidence and all that, instead of kind of the alternative, which is, you know, searching for the policy-based evidence when you've already decided what you want to do, which is often nothing or something wrong, and then you look for the evidence that supposedly supports it and find someone who says that's agreed. Can better comms and end up with a better dialogue across all of the policies that we'd like to do, not central banking per se, but also social policies and structural policies and AI and so forth from there, and bring in a wider audience that are not, you know, as attuned to some of the nuances we are, but nonetheless have a view and a perspective. I'll probably take all three of you on that question before I turn over to Q&A with Sarah. Would you like to start on that?
Yeah, I mean, I might imagine I'll come at this from a central bank lens, but to pick up on the earlier conversation, I think it is really absolutely vital and incumbent on us as central bankers to communicate better with the whole of the country, everyone with all of their different perspectives. We are mandated to set policy for everyone. We are here to serve and improve the welfare of all Australians. So we have to be talking to the whole country, and that's on us to do that. And we've made a number of changes in the last couple of years following the review to help us do that. We're only just starting on the journey, and we're learning and hopefully improving all the time. But I do very strongly feel like it's our responsibility to do that, and we have to learn how to communicate in a way that means that what we're saying is understood. And in doing that, we should hopefully end up with better outcomes as well, because if people can understand the decisions that we're making and why we're making them, even if they disagree with them, just understanding them should result in better outcomes, because people will make decisions in a way that's, you know, sort of consistent with their with that understanding, and that's going to improve things. So we're very much focused on this. I also think it's really important that we're very honest about what we're learning through time and how we're improving. And to your point, we had a discussion earlier around sort of high inflation and the outcome from COVID and what the alternative might have been at the start of the pandemic if the supports haven't been there. It is really important, though, that we learn constantly from our policies and what we've done and what we could do better in the future. And to that end, we've actually, this isn't a plug, but it is relevant to this, we've published a whole series of reviews of those unconventional policies that we enacted through the pandemic. We've just finished with the term funding facility just this week. Please, if you're keen, have a read. But the important point I'm trying to make here is that we are showing and we are learning internally, and we're doing that critical analysis to improve for next time. And we're being really open and transparent with the public about what happened, what we've learnt. In that particular case, we're aware of the cost of that policy. We've been honest about that, and I think that's really, really important. Really important for building that trust and credibility in the institution. That's a central bank perspective, but I think some of those lessons, I'm sure Shane and Mark can comment further, would apply to other policy settings too. So.
I think, is there one? Yeah, you referred to the basic problem in Australia is the lack of productivity growth. Some would argue maybe the numbers aren't quite as bad as they look, but particularly in the private sector, once you adjust for mining and growth in the public sector, but still you've got a problem. Even in the private sector, productivity growth hasn't been that good, and it is the basic driver of growth in living standards, unless the Chinese keep paying us more. So that's a big challenge. I was fortunate to start my career at a time when the political pendulum or the economic pendulum had swung towards, I guess, free market solutions. And so governments at the time were keen to adopt those solutions, you know, deregulation, solutions that involved getting government out of the way or facilitating the private sector to get things done. And that helped us dramatically through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. Productivity growth surged and our living standards rose. But the environment is now very different. The political pendulum has swung towards government intervention. So solutions that involve more government, like getting better childcare, or more infrastructure spending, many of those things get up, and I think that's very important, but a lot of the other reforms get forgotten about. The Reserve Bank, I think, has rightly, over many, many years, highlighted the problems with productivity and regularly said, I think Governor Stevens regularly said, well, people would say, what do we do about it? Well, the Productivity Commission has a list, go and look at the list. I think they then had to make up the list. They'd already had it in all their reports, but they then put a list out. But those things are out there. We know what we need to do, but we just lack the desire to do them. This evidence-based approach that you refer to, I think several things have to happen. One is you have to have a crisis. We haven't had enough of a crisis so far. And when you have a crisis, people demand change. And that's what happened going into the 1980s. Secondly, you need politicians with conviction, as opposed to politicians who just operate on the latest focus group or the latest opinion polls. And those sort of politicians, unfortunately, are somewhat thinner on the ground these days. So you arguably need a change in the sort of politicians we have. Hopefully they won't all hate on me. There are some good ones out there, but they're the things I think we need. Change in the way politicians do things, and unfortunately, to get change, you really need a crisis.
Michael, so just briefly, and then I'll want to turn to Q&A to give a few chunks in there.
Yeah, so I think media also has a role to play. You know, I think often the way choices are framed, you know, do you want lower taxes? Yeah. Do you want lower taxes if that means you're going to have some other outcome that's not very desirable? Are we giving people trade-offs, or are we just letting them choose, you know, the best bits they want? And fiscal discussion, certainly in the UK and Ireland, is generally of a pretty poor level, given, you know, the choices that need to be made. But I will say one thing. I'm going to bring this back to central banks because it's the area of my research that I worked on, and I want to stress this because it's A, very new. So because I'm now in Australia at the moment, we're working on it 24 hours a day, because it's myself, an Australian who's based in Oxford, Peter Rickards, and my former postdoc who's now in Mississippi, Ryan Rolls. And we've actually been testing education effects on people's understanding of central bank decisions, their trust in central banks. And you can have a huge impact by realizing that actually most people don't have the same models in our head as we do as economists. So if you look at the average central bank statement, it says things like, oh, inflation is running at this level. The wages are increasing strongly and the labor market looks tight. Output is expected to continue to grow. We have decided to raise interest rates. Now, the economists in the room have heard that. They've mapped it through a model. They've thought Phillips curves. They've thought tightness. They've thought this is obvious. Most people don't think it's obvious. Most people think if you put interest rates up, costs for firms will go up and therefore they'll have to put prices up. The cost channel of monetary policy, which we do talk about, is often in surveys shown to be the dominant effect of interest rates in people's heads. We've got to change that, and there are ways to do it, and there's now forthcoming evidence that we're producing that shows how you can actually do it, and it does involve central banks being a little bit more explicit in the links they have in their head about what the causal channels will be. And I don't think it's very hard, but it will take a bit of a change, and I think we need it on fiscal as well, and probably other areas as well.
Big agenda. Okay, let's turn to Q&A. Could I ask just two things for Q&A? One, we have, this is being filmed, and so we do have some roaming mics. Please just hold your question before you get the mic. And secondly, could you please be very short in your question? We really are for questions, not statements, from here. So could I please ask, down the front here to start off with.
Hi, thanks. That was a great panel and a great talk. In terms of the central bank decision-making in containing the inflation and the only key tool, monetary policy, why would central bank not hammer that tool till the results are achieved in shortest time frames instead of dragging it on? It takes out the issue of being in limelight and explaining all the time.
For us, specifically for the Reserve Bank here, so I won't talk to other central banks, the board are very conscious of the dual mandate, the two parts of the mandate. So the inflation part of the mandate, but then the full employment part of the mandate that I mentioned earlier on. And there is, in the short term, there is a trade-off in achieving both of those when you're trying to bring inflation down. And so being really clear on that, the board are really clear about that, but that is a reflection of the stance. And so in the statements, you'll see lots of references to inflation is clearly above the target, and it is the concern right now. But the board are also very concerned with protecting the gains that have been made in the labour market. So we've currently, even though it's come up a little bit, the unemployment rate is well below where it was pre-COVID, for example. We've had very strong employment growth through the last few years. And so it's balancing those two things. That's what the board are trying to do with their policy decision. And so the cash rate is where it is. But it's a reflection of that and a reflection of that mandate.
Can I add an answer on that just very quickly?
Yep.
I mean, even in countries where they don't have a secondary mandate issue, the the long and variable lags of interest rates mean you would never want to try and hit inflation in 3 months' time. Because what you'd have to do, you'd basically be like steering a car where you swing it so wildly that the car is going to start veering after you achieve it, and then you're going to have to swing back wildly. So just from a pure volatility management point of view, you have to be thinking 2 years out. And that always necessitates slightly slower than you're, I think, suggesting.
Second question, the lady there.
Hi. Thank you all for the talk. And you all have talked about the value of central banks being open in communications, being transparent, and this new trend lately. But do you think the demand for transparency has gone too far? Have there been a lot of negatives and making central banks' jobs actually harder?
Let me start with Sarah. No,
I don't think that it's gone too far. I think that it's important that we are transparent. It's important that we're held to account. That's actually really critical. We have to deliver, and we have to be. Someone has to be able to stand us up and assess that. And there's various ways that can happen. As I mentioned earlier, through Parliament holding us to account, but also the media, the broader public holding us to account. So, no, I don't think we've swung too far by any stretch. I think it's really important to all of the points that have been made by the other panelists that we explain what we're doing and why we're doing it, what we think is happening, why we might be wrong about that, and what that might mean. So I don't think that we're too transparent by any stretch, and we're exploring other ways to be more transparent. So I think the direction of travel is still to go further.
Thank you very much. I think Sarah's been extremely popular tonight. I was a question that pointed to Sarah Bowl, actually diverted to the panel here. So we are making quite a bit of decisions and communication to the public based on the data we can collect and we have. How do we make sure that the data we collect is a reflection of the factual present?
Goodness, I feel like we need someone from the ABS here. So we're very lucky here in Australia and most advanced economies as well. We have the Australian Bureau of Statistics, so they're the independent statistics authority. It's their job to collect the majority of the data that that we certainly work with. We collect a little bit ourselves around financial markets, information, the securitization mortgage database, for example, but the vast majority of our data comes from the ABS. And they're tasked with ensuring its quality and provision to the whole country in a very open and transparent way. You can go on their website and get lots of information, and it's an incredible array of data. Having said all of that, they would be the first people to say that no data series is perfect. We can't, for example, we can't ask absolutely everybody with a job, what's your job? How many hours are you working? What precisely do you get paid? We just can't gather their information in that way. We couldn't possibly do that survey. So there are all sorts of reasons why the data is a representation of what's happening. But the ABS do incredible work. We're incredibly lucky to have them. And so we're able to use their data and trust that it is representative.
So just to add on to that, I used to work at the IMF, and they have a huge statistics department, go around the world providing TA. The Australian ABS was regarded as the absolute best of all the world statistics, and that's 191 countries, so that's pretty impressive. Garth.
It's worth just pointing out that all data that you might want to collect is out of date by the time you have it. That is the fact. Okay, so I think I'm gonna rephrase your question, because I think the data can be high quality. The real question is, how do we ensure that we have highly qualified people using the best possible processes to convert what data signals we get that's necessarily from the past to give us a sensible view? And in the answer I just gave to this gentleman about the fact that we need to think 2 years out, how can we also have forecasting processes, which again are by definition difficult, even in a stable world, but in a constantly changing world, they're really tricky. That's why we should encourage independent central banks and fiscal authorities and private sector banks and everyone to be sort of doing this, producing their own forecasts and contributing to the narrative and the discussion. But you'll always get it wrong. That's one of the joys of, once you accept that, being a forecaster is quite fun.
That's the messy world in which we live. Final question, Adam.
Excellent, thank you. I've been quite confused by the government's messaging this year that they're budgets are reducing inflation, and you know we're talking about headline or underlying core inflation. Can you provide a more generous interpretation of the government's messaging than it's just a election budget? And how much could it be true that like the top-down government messaging is altering expectations, which is altering inflation?
That's a problem. It is true when you run a budget surplus, you're taking more money out of the economy than you're putting in as a government. So in that sense, the government can claim that it's bearing down on inflation. But it's not the only indicator you can look at it in terms of the stance of fiscal policy. Ideally, you should look at the cyclically adjusted budget deficit, and you'll find a lot of the elements that we're giving the budget surplus were cyclical. And in a policy sense, there's a thing called the table of truth in the budget. There's actually been a fiscal easing. So that's what happened to parameter changes. We got stronger economic growth and higher commodity prices. Money rolled in. They got a surplus. What were they doing in terms of the policy decisions? They're actually loosening policy and partly offsetting that. So if you look at it that way, more money was getting pumped into the economy. So it depends on which aspect of those two things you focus on. I initially thought, well, okay, they've got a surplus, that's good. But as time's gone by and I've seen that growth in public spending, I have become more concerned about the contribution of that to inflation. And just one final point on the transparency. I think the Reserve Bank does a fantastic job. The economic reforms, the reform of the Reserve Bank proposed with the new board does worry me a little bit. One of the aspects of that was that board members, so there'd be six independent economists on the new board, they would be out there giving speeches. And I do worry that that would lead to excessive communication and confusion. And you see that in the US, where you've got lots of Fed speakers out there saying different things on different days. So I kind of think things need to stay about where they are. You can tweak it and improve a little bit. But having lots of independent economists out there saying things off the board could confuse things and reduce the authority of the Reserve Bank.
And I do worry that if we get into that issue, then we will have excessive length on this session and never get home tonight. So I'm going to call it quits on that one. Can I ask the panel to stay seated?